That was episode 7 of Journey into Space. Taking part in this recording were Andrew Foles as Jet Morgan, Alfie Bass as Lemmy, Guy Kingsley Pointer as Doc, and Don Sharp as Mitch. Other parts were played by David Jacobs. The orchestra was conducted by Van Phillips, who also composed the music. Journey into Space was written and produced for the BBC by Charles Chilton.
Ooh, that's what you call a cliffhanger. And hang we shall until tomorrow at the same time.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Next on 4 Extra, Mark Radcliffe takes a look at the life and career of Albert Arthur Powell, a.k.a. Sandy Powell.
Shall I do a bit of crooning?
Yes, yeah, sure,
right,
Sandy.
You are. I've just been to the Angel, where angels are so few. There I sat all day till one came along, said I'll drink along with you. Boo-boo-boo-boo-boo.
The voice of Sandy Powell. A mildly amusing example of the parlour song, so beloved of the Victorians for whom an evening of such entertainment provided quite a racy night out. It's a song that's never going to offend, and it's unlikely that Sandy Powell upset anybody throughout his entire career. But if that makes him sound dull, well, he wasn't. He had routines that still work today, jokes that have worn considerably better than the songs. He was born Albert Arthur Powell in Rotherham in 1900, and nicknamed Sandy because of his red hair. And he was born into a theatrical family. His dad was a lowly stagehand, but his mum was a star. Of sorts. She went under the name of Lily Lemaine and ran an act called Lilette's Living Marionettes. It was with his mum's act that Sandy first trod the boards, at the tender age of 9.
My mother, she had this little velvet suit with the lace collar. It fitted me, so she put it on me, and I went on and sang. The very first song was Sweet 16. I love you as I never loved before. When first I met you on come to me, oh, my dream of love. I love you as I loved you when you were sweet,
when you were sweet, 16.
Isn't that nice?
Oh, it is nice. Sandy was always nice, and he was especially nice to his mother, Norman Meadow, theatre manager and fellow performer.
Sandy was completely devoted to his mother. It goes back to way back, I think, almost at the time he was born as a little boy. And I think she groomed him as she was his mentor in his early years. And he supported his mother wonderfully well right the way through all her life.
Come on, Mother, I think you ought to say something yourself.
Can you hear me, listeners? I am very proud to be with my son. And like Sandy, Halifax will always have a warm corner in my heart.
Yes, we've played Halifax a few times, haven't we, Mother?
Yes, we have. As a matter of fact, it's over 30 years since I first appeared on the Halifax stage, on the Palace stage.
And what was I doing then, Mother?
Mother and son aren't wireless together. Bless. All right, it all sounds a tad sentimental. It's more than a bit cheesy, but he does get funny, I promise. And his bond with his mother shaped his whole career. We're in Jimmy Clitheroe territory here, or we may even have uncovered a comedian's Oedipus complex. Which is not to suggest that their relationship was in any way weird. Not weird at all.
Mum would be dressed in possibly a black evening dress with the diamante and the necklaces, etc., etc., and Sandy would have a dress made which would match entirely to Mum's, and he had a wig which matched his mum's hair, and they would walk down in the finale together, virtually as sisters. And this was the gimmick, and this is the thing they did every year on Mum's birthday.
Now, just hang on a minute. I love my mum, but not once have I felt moved to dress like her, on her birthday or any other day. Sandy toured for years with his mother's marionette show, but eventually he got the chance to branch out on his own.
I remember we were working a little cinema, well, my mother was, in Newcastle-on-Tyne, and there was an audition, there was a little juvenile review going out on these cinemas. So I went in this audition, and they booked me as the principal comedian, 12 and sixpence a week and live in. And there were about 12 or 14 kids. We did this little show. And the man running the show, he said, "Now, who is your favourite comedian?" He said, "You've got to plan your style on somebody." "Oh," I said, "Harry Weldon." He said, "Then you work like Harry Weldon." And he said, "Then you'll gradually develop your own personality and leave Harry Weldon out of it."
Sound advice. I became a DJ on Radio 1 in much the same way, mimicking the mannerisms of others until my own voice gradually emerged to the extent that there's barely a trace of Alan Fluff Freeman remaining today, not after 8 pop pickers, all right? Slowly then, Sandy Powell escaped from his mother's shadow and began to build an act and a reputation. And then he got what nearly every successful person in show business has had at some time. A lucky break. Former BBC Light Entertainment producer Mike Craig.
He was working, doing his impressions and his few songs at the famous City Varieties in Leeds. He was only young, he'd be about 19, 17, 18, and Wee Georgie Wood was appearing at the Dewsbury Empire, 6 miles away. Wee Georgie Wood was taken ill, and the two managers of the theatres got in touch with one another, and Sandy went over to Dewsbury to stand in for Wee Georgie Wood. In the audience that night at Dewsbury was a London agent. Instead of seeing Georgie Wood, he saw Sandy, and he went round to see him. He had to dash for his train, but he said, "I want to get in touch with you. You're just what I want. I've got a lot of bookings I can give you. A big tour of the Northern Theatres." And that was his first bit of luck.
The agent was impressed, and Sandy's career was about to take off, although not in an entirely predictable way. In those days, to make it to the top, you toured backstreet theatres, living in dingy boarding houses run by frosty old trouts who tried to poison you by feeding you tripe and cow eel or jugged hare. Sandy would bypass years of all that by making records. He was going to be the UK's first pop star. And like all great recording artists, he'd have an influence on later performers like Ken Dodd.
I was brought up on Sandy, and I think he gave me my first love of first wanting to be a comedian, because I was brought up on Sandy Powell's gramophone records, Sandy the Lodger, Sandy the Fireman, Sandy the Taxi Driver, Sandy Amongst the Loonies. Now, see if I can do me Sandy Powell. "Can you hear me, Mother?" Sounds more like Dave Forrester. I've been a doctor and a policeman and a fireman. I've been a keeper at the zoo. And now I've got a job in this asylum, and it won't be long before I'm balmy too.
So what was on these records?
Oh, I did everything. Sandy the Sailor, Sandy the Soldier, Sandy the Road Sweeper. I did all of them. I made my first record in 1929, and I went to the studio, and the producer, he said, what are you going to do? I said, "Well, I can't sing, you know." It's, "Well, that's peculiar. If you're going to make a record, what are you going to do?" I said, "Well, can you suggest anything?" He said, "Well, you're at the Palladium this week." I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, whatever it is you're doing at the Palladium, let's try that." And it was The Lost Policeman.
"Hello, little girl. Hey, what are you crying for?"
"Can you tell me where I can find the policeman?"
"What do you think I am, a sea lion or something? Why, what do you want a policeman for?"
"Our Herbert's in the river."
"Your Herbert's in the river?"
"Yes."
"Has he been in long?"
"Oh, not long."
"Oh, that's all right. He'll get used to it when he's been in a bit, you know. Tell me, has he ever been in the river before?"
"No."
"Oh, well, it'll be a change for him then. Can your Herbert swim?"
"No."
"Well, now's his chance to learn."
I said, "Do I get paid or anything like that?" He said, "You have £60 for the full rights Or, he said, you can have a halfpenny a side, two-sided record, a halfpenny each side. Oh, I said, well, I didn't expect anything at all. I said, so I'll take the halfpenny. He says, that might sound all right.
It's hard to see George Michael and Prince signing contracts like that. A royalty rate of a penny a record? You were never going to get rich on a deal like that, were you?
The recording manager, Bill Hanson, came round to see him. He said, I've got a pleasant surprise for you. I said, really? He said, yeah. He said, you know you made that record. I said, well, honestly, I'd forgotten all about it. I said, why, what's happened? He said, it's a success. He said, here's your cheque for the first month, £175. Oh, I said, that's fine. I said, but a good job I didn't take the £60.
Over the next 12 years, Sandy Powell made over 100 records. In the time it takes Madonna to remix a B-side, Sandy would have churned out another 20 78s. And they sold a lot, around 7.5 million. Now, even at a penny a record, that's a lot of cash. 7.5 million pennies in old money, divide by 240, you work it out. I've done it already and I make it loads. But it wasn't just the money. Mike Craig.
The main thing it did was, before the wireless, before Bandwagon, people had his records on their wind-up gramophones. And so Sandy Powell was in everybody's house who'd bought the record. That meant that when he came round later to their town with his roadshow, everybody knew Sandy Powell because they had his records.
Oh, he was an astute businessman. Don't forget that right the way through that period, that era of mid and late 30s, he was what, in today's terms, you call a megastar.
All the comedians in this series have been workaholics. All the comedians in this series have been well off. Some of them stayed well off by being notorious skinflints. Not Sandy.
We were touring with the late Evelyn Leigh. And Evelyn was responsible for the bill. It was a complete variety bill. She was the star of the bill. Sandy was second. And at the end of the week, Sandy had a feeling that that week would probably be a loss leader as far as she was concerned. And he wouldn't accept his complete salary. He went to her and took a cut in salary because business hadn't been all that good.
Blimey, Charlie, he's an angel, this fella. But in many ways, he was born to succeed. His family background was practically aristocratic.
I can remember my mother saying to me when I started to do well, she said, well, you've done very, very well. She said, when I think how we all started, she said, you can always be proud to say that your mother was born in the biggest house in Rotherham. Oh, I said, I'll remember that. I said, did it have a name? She said, yes, the workhouse.
I'll tell you what we'll do. Let's all go into the workhouse at 8:30 tomorrow morning. We'll all meet when showers march along the street. Women and children first.
Yes, all right, it's another parlour song, but we get into the good stuff, I promise. So far, we've proved beyond all reasonable doubt that he was a warm and engaging performer and a thoroughly decent chap, but we've yet to prove that he was actually funny. But he was funny. At least, he was getting there. He was honing his style. Norman Meadow.
Well, his style of comedy was the common man, wasn't it? Again, like a lot of the great comedians, they based their comedy, really, on the common man and observation, and he came across as an inoffensive little fella. And in certain aspects, if you were doing comedy with him, which demanded from you an overpowering role, or you beat him down verbally, that would, in turn, he would, in an expression on his face, gain more sympathy from the audience. He was a poor little fella that was beaten down all the time.
What my style was really, and even to this day, is burlesquing, taking the mickey out of something dead straight and serious. And I just exaggerated.
As a comedian, Sandy Powell was developing all the time. But as with the lucky break, one of the principal reasons his immortality is assured happened entirely by accident. He hit on a catchphrase. And if you ask people of a certain vintage what they remember about Sandy Powell, the first thing they'll say, apart from possibly, hang on a minute, I'll just put me teeth in, will be, can you hear me, Mother?
That was only a line. It wasn't meant at all to be a catchphrase. There was no thought of that. I was supposed to be at the North Pole broadcasting home, and I said, I want to speak to my mother. And this was a line in the sketch. Can you hear me, Mother, you see? And then, right in the middle of it, I dropped my script on the floor. I hadn't had the sense to pin the pages together. And in picking them up and sorting it out, I said this a couple of times more, you see? And I didn't think any more about it, only that I thought I'd overdone it, you see? That was on the Saturday night. On the Monday, I was at Coventry Hippodrome. And the manager came out. He said, Sandy, you'll say that tonight, won't you? I said, say what? He said, can you hear me, Mother? I said, why? He said, everybody's saying it. Well, I went on the stage, can you hear me, Mother? And everybody in the theatre joined in with me, you see? And that's how it was born.
So he had a catchphrase, a few impressions, a handful of gags, and a couple of comparatively dull parlour songs. Hardly the stuff of comic legend. But that all changed with the inept ventriloquist. Now that really was funny.
We were at Barrow-in-Furness, and I'd got a bill in there. I used to put my own little shows in. And my agent, he said, I've got you a marvellous ventriloquist, you see. So this fellow went on, and he was dreadful. Didn't get any laughs. I thought, oh, dear. And I rang up my agent. I said, this fellow's no good. You told me it was funny. He said, well, you can't see his lips. I said, I want to hear the audience laughing. I said, I don't get it if he moves his lips. I said, anyway, don't book any more. He said, I'm afraid I've got you another one for next week. He said, but he is very good. And for 3 weeks, I had one of these terrible ventriloquists. And I thought, how can I get my own back? What can I do? So I bought this little doll I've had all these years. I think I paid a fiver for it. And did it just as a gag, just to please me and the company, you see. It was only a 2-minute gag, and I didn't mean it as an act. And anyway, it gradually built up, and we put little bits into it, and it developed into my living, really.
Tell me, my little man, how are you this evening? He says he's very well. And tell me, have you any brothers and sisters? I've got 3 brothers and 3 sisters.
Here, I say, I saw your lips move then.
You mind your own business.
It's funny just listening to the lines, without seeing Sandy in his scarlet military Sergeant Pepper uniform wrestling with the decrepit dummy that's disintegrating before your eyes, and being interrupted by the elegant lady in the black evening gown, in reality Sandy's wife Kay. It's still a brilliant act today, but back then it was daringly original. Going on stage with the intention of being rubbish. Deconstructing one of the familiar elements of variety. Sandy Powell may well have been the first comic postmodernist. Dr. Oliver Double of Liverpool John Moores University.
Variety entertainment tended to be quite safe and conservative stylistically. And variety comedy certainly was. There were certain kind of group of kind of stock subjects, and people didn't tend to deviate very far from that. But what's interesting is within variety comedy, there was also some kind of rebellion against that and some kind of satirising of these rigid conventions. And what Sandy Powell did was he did the satire on the ventriloquist, which is quite a sophisticated idea.
Now tell me, are you going to sing for the ladies and gentlemen?
I say, will he sing anything by request?
Oh, he'd sing anything by request.
Will he?
As long as I know it, he'll sing it.
Well, will he sing something? something for me?
For you, certainly.
Oh, good. Out of Mary Poppins.
Yes.
You know the one. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
If he does, he'll sing it by himself.
And there's something about his character when he does the Chelsea pensioner ventriloquist that is not only funny, there's something heartrending about it as well. You know, this, where he kind of goes, where do you come from? And he kind of goes, Wolverhampton or something. And, you know, and you see his desperation, you see his sweating, you see the kind of the whole thing falling apart and him losing control. And there's something very kind of sad about it as well as it being funny.
Sad, funny and wildly successful. So successful he decided to repeat the formula. Mike Craig.
So we decided to do the same sort of thing with a magician. A magician who was incompetent. Not your Tommy Cooper, who knew he was incompetent. One who thought the audience hadn't seen the mistakes he'd made. And his magic act, of course, in my opinion, was probably the best thing he did. It was just remarkable. Not a word spoken, but this inept conjurer comes on and produces a lovely dove from a handkerchief, which sits on his finger and just wobbles as he moves his finger. And when the trick's over and the applause has come, he just folds the dove in half and puts it in his pocket. It's a rubber one. Brilliant stuff.
One of the acts didn't turn up to go on at Chiswick Empire. And on the bill we had Jack DeMain, who was marvellous with the cards and cigarettes, billiard balls, and he had the cloak and tall hat, silver mounted walking stick. So I went in his dressing room. I said, Jack, will you help me? I said, we've got to fill in 5 or 6 minutes because one of the turns hasn't turned up. He said, yes, what do you want? I said, well, give me your cloak and your hat and stick. And I went on with a cigarette and messed about for a few minutes. And there again, it turned out to be quite a good item for me.
Like all the comedians we've discussed in this series, the heartland of their fan base was the north of England. And most of them struggled to repeat their success in the south, or at least in London's West End. Would Sandy Powell fare any better?
When the war started, you know, we were all closed down. And then about a month afterwards, they allowed us to open the theatres. I opened several theatres, the New Theatre, Oxford, the Royal Hanley, the Hippodrome, Bristol, for the Stole circuit, and we did very well. And then Sir Oswald Stole sent for me. He said, well, you've done very well, Sandy. You've opened several of our theatres. How about trying the West End? He said, would you like to put your show in at the London Coliseum? And like a fool, I said, yes. Well, to cut a long story short, I was there for 3 weeks. I lost £2,000. And Sir Oswald, I went to see him. I said, let me go back into the provinces and the suburbs where I really belong. So we opened the Chiswick Empire and we got normal again.
Everything was normal again and the cash continued to roll in. Theatres, radio, records and next, films.
I made 7 altogether. The first one was the Third String, W.W. Jacobs story. Mm-hmm. And then I went with the British Lion Corporation and I did 6 for them. It's a Grand Old World, I've Got a Horse, Home from Home.
One of Sandy's support cast was a little-known 21-year-old called Pat Pilkington. She'd later change her name to Pat Phoenix, and as Elsie Tanner in Coronation Street would eat blokes like Sandy Powell for breakfast. And dinner. And tea.
I was brought in to play Sandy's wife, and as I was only 21 at the time and a bit raw, I thought, well, how's this going to work? But may I tell you, I played 4 parts in that film, all with the same face and the same hair.
So she played the part and made herself look more like the age of myself, you see. after we finished the picture, I went on tour in Variety, and she came with me doing the feeding in the sketches. And she got big money in those days, too. £12 a week.
Oh, same old Sally, always looking for trouble.
I'm not looking for trouble. I want some food, that's all. Anyway, I can't eat it like this. Give me some bread.
I've got no bread.
Well, give me some toast.
No, you haven't, Otter. Do you want a row?
Why, do you want a row?
I don't mind.
Oh, well, you haven't, Otter.
But full of wit and charm as he was, it would be a mistake to pretend that Sandy's films were classics. Biographer Harry Stanley.
Some of them are not so good. They were quickies compared with the great films of today, but they were great in, they must be kept in context. They were great in then and entertained people, particularly up north, although it was a great shock to distributors to find that his films were going very well in the south. They were very dubious about that.
Do you want me to sing, Alice?
Yes.
All right, well, Alice, if I do sing, will you promise me one thing?
What's that?
If ever we have a row, you won't throw it up in my face, will you?
No, darling.
All right. When I was a right young lad, my father said to me, seems to me that's growing up, now what's that going to be?
Oops, sorry, back to the songs again. On stage, Sandy Powell continued to delight audiences with his meticulous ineptitude. Unlike many comedians, he wasn't a big boozer or in any way a womaniser. His only vice was working, and working in Variety was brutal. Into his 80s, he was doing three spots in a show, evenings and matinees. He began to fade. His wife, Kay.
We had a lovely night to do in Coventry, and we're both of us sitting in the train, and as usual, I've got the bag with me, our cocktail bag, as we called it, and he said, shall we have a little drink? And I said, yes, all right then. And I said, I'd get out the glasses and his whiskey, and we'd have a little drink. And I said, suddenly in that way of his, he looked across at me and he said, this isn't us, is it? I said, well, not really, Sandy. He said, I think I'll pack it up. He said, I think I've had enough. He said, you know what we'll do? We'll do a cruise round the world. I said, well, that's a lovely idea. And I said, that's the best thing I've heard you say for a long time. So he said, well, I said, did you really want to pack it up? I said, I've wanted to pack it up for a long time, but I said, you were so happy working and you loved it so much. I said, I would never suggest it. Coventry was very, very special. At the end of the show, he was absolutely marvellous, and he said to the audience, I'm sure you'd be interested to know that it was 50 years ago in this very town when I first said, can you hear me, mother? He didn't realise that it was the last time that he said it. In Coventry, where he loved it.
Sandy Powell died of a heart attack on June the 26th, 1982. For a day or two, he'd been saying he had indigestion. It turned out to be a bit more than that. The lasting memory seems to be of one of life's good guys. Thoughtful, warm, loving husband, nice to his mum. The kind of bloke me grandma would have called, with an admiring nod, a gent. But ultimately, none of that matters. You don't get remembered for being nice. You get remembered for being good at what you do. And as a comic, he was good. Really good.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, before I leave you, I'd like to say a little thing, five little words I've been saying on the wireless for 50 years. Can you hear me, Mother?
How Tickled Am I was presented by Mark Radcliffe and produced by Bernadette McConnell. Next week, Mark's focus turns to the now Knight of Knotty Ash, Sir Ken Dodd, at the same time. How tickled we'll be at the same time next week.
The Comedy Club on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Josh Howie is with me in the studio. I've got a lot to talk about with you, Josh. First of all, you love films.
Obsessed.
Well, and can I just say, can you not mention the word movie while we're talking? Because I find that Americanization of what is a beautiful art form, I find it very irritating.
This is very political, this material here. But yes, I will say cinema. Can I say cinema?
You can say like cinema as much as you want.
That's okay.
The pictures. You can say that if you
want. I wouldn't do the pictures, no.
Don't you go to the pictures?
No, I go to the cinema.
Okay.
That's just, well, I'm a classy guy, and that's what I do.
You probably live in London.
I probably do.
Well, I was going to say, yeah. I'm interviewing you now, but obviously you are a dab hand at the interview yourself. And one of the areas where you do those interviews is on a red carpet.
Indeed.
I've watched some of those interviews, and frankly, I found them a little bit alarming.
In what way?
You've come across a bit creepy.
Really?
Mark Strong, yeah. you sort of said you
were... Oh, sort of I was definitely a little bit creepy
and
with him.
And he went, oh!
I'm a little bit obsessed with Mark Strong.
Why?
Because of his lack of hair. As you can see, yeah. I am losing my hair.